Okay, hello everybody. My name is Bill Kassan. I'm a lecturer in the government department, and I'm also a member of the Conflict Research Group, which is organizing this panel as part of its public events program. We've got quite a lot to get through today, and thanks for coming. I realize many of you will just be busy with revising and worrying about exams. We've got a lot to get through. We've got five speakers. James Hughes, Professor of Comparative Politics here at the LSE. Rebecca Friedman, who is a lecturer in international relations in King's College London. Nadeem Rouhana, who is Professor of International Negotiation and Conflict Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, Tufts University. I can never pronounce Denise's name properly. Denisa Kostovichova, who is an associate professor in the government department. And finally, Rachel Kerr, who is a reader in international relations and contemporary war in King's College London next door. So we're going to get the presentations in that order. And hopefully, by the time we get to about 20 past seven, We'll be finished and we'll have a question and answer session, which I will moderate. So you can see here that these books are up at the table. They're special issues of the journal. I think we have representatives of the Journal of Ethnic and Racial Studies here. So Jim will be talking about one of the latest editions of this special issue, which is devoted to the topic of reconciliation and also his own contribution to that. Okay, Jim.
Well, thank you very much, Phil, and thank you, everyone, for coming. I suppose from my own perspective, my interest in the idea of reconciliation, and that was my main input, in England was much more focused on the transitional justice side of things. But my interest in reconciliation preceded this by many, many years. I think one of the first things that struck me as an interesting idea was when Desmond Tutu produced his book, I think in 1999, No Future Without Forgiveness, and there was a little, I think, probably throwaway comment in there where he said that it wasn't all of the structures of apartheid and the power of the state and so on that really kind of got to him. It was the what he called the pinpricks of the routine of daily humiliation and discrimination and insult. And it was that idea of this kind of the everyday existence in a deeply divided place, a deeply divided society, and how do you overcome a history of accumulated pinpricks, essentially? Now, that was back in 1989, and it's now 2018. That's how long it took for that idea to kind of germinate in my head, eventually get around to writing, after writing a lot of other things and working on a lot of other things. But that was probably the kind of germ. The original genesis of the idea. I knew I would write something about reconciliation eventually, I just didn't know when it would happen. And when we sat down to plan the special issue, both of us really wanted to do something a little bit different, because there has been a huge explosion in the literature in both of these concepts since the early 90s, related to the aftermath of fall of communism and the transition to democracy and human rights agenda, and the whole idea of international intervention, actually, because transitional justice has become a form of international intervention, ultimately. And we wanted to do something a little bit different against the background of this huge literature. And we wanted to do something a little bit more critical. Both of us come from places where we have had experience of conflict, and so we felt more sort of sensitized to the issues and to the complexities of the issues, and all of the nuances, all the gray zone of those issues. We didn't come at the concepts from a very normative rosy-tinted perspective. We knew that these are hard, tough issues and require a lot of hard and tough compromises, both at the theoretical and in the practical level. So we wanted to do something that was more critical, and we wanted to look at maybe cases that were not typical cases. It's a bit like, I remember discussing with Denise, one of the things I said was, well, let's say genocide, you know what? So I talk about genocide in my course, and students write dissertations about genocide. You know, probably 95% of the dissertations I get on genocide are about Rwanda. Mm. And I was like, why don't they write about something else? And I think it's partly because of the certain familiarity, but there's also a certain comfort about writing about a case not too close to home, not too challenging, an obvious case in a way. So we wanted to avoid that kind of, you know, obviousness in dealing with cases of reconciliation, transitional justice. So I think what we ended up with in the end were maybe unusual cases to some extent, or even if they are usual cases, because Rwanda is in there, they are a usual case that's looked at a little bit unusually. So that was kind of what we were trying to do. But when you look at the cases in the issue, I'll just very quickly tell you what they were. I wrote about Northern Ireland. We had an article about race in the United States of America and the case for reparations, the case for race in the United States as an example of a reparations case within transitional justice. We had the issue of race in Australia and, you know, the denial of harm to Indigenous peoples in Australia for many years, and all of the sort of the political issues that arise from trying to face up to that issue more recently. We had Nadine writing about the Palestinian and Israeli case, looking at reconciliation and transitional justice from the perspective of how he frames it as an issue of separate colonialism. And we had some cases dealing with the past. We had Rebecca looking at Peru and the attempts to deal with the truth recovery issues around the conflicts in Peru. We had a case study of Rwanda and how the regime is using reconciliation and transitional justice for political purposes of regime consolidation. Denise wrote about the Western Balkans, again looking much more at bottom-up discourses around these issues rather than, you know, more elitist or state-led or international-only-led discourses. And finally, we had an article about the Kurds, which looked at how, given the Kurds are kind of distant from the Turkish state in some places, how they have invented a kind of do-it-yourself process of trying to come to terms with the past and dealing with justice issues. Now, many of these cases are not the kind of usual cases you will find in the literature, or at least the way that we've looked at them is not usual. We've also, to some extent, maybe not as explicitly as we could have, but certainly it's there. There is this subtext of colonial legacies in most of these cases, actually, have a subtext of colonial legacy and everything that goes with that about power, asymmetry of power, prejudice, structuring of power and prejudice through colonial legacies. And I suppose the overall linking theme was contrasting the kind of normative agenda that's developed since the 1990s about what should be done to deal with the past in post-conflict societies, with contrasting that with actually what happens in practice and what is not happening in practice in some cases. And a final thought I would suggest is that certainly something that we bring out in the introduction is that actually both of these concepts are as much as they're to do with building a new future and peace building and so forth and moving beyond the conflict, actually in practice, very often they become a new dimension for the conflict to be fought out itself. They're actually, you know, a continuation of the conflict itself in many cases. So that's by way of introduction. Maybe should I carry on and say, how much time have we got for?
7 minutes.
7 minutes, okay. So 7 minutes on Northern Ireland. In my own piece then on Northern Ireland, I did two things. One was I tried to, given the limitations of space in the introduction, I tried to devote more space to the issue of reconciliation itself and then use the case of Northern Ireland to kind of explore the concept. And in my discussion about the concept, I focused very much on the conventional ambiguities. What strikes me is the very ambiguous use of this concept, almost so ambiguous as to be meaningless in most usages. And there's a kind of there's this combination of a kind of pre-lapsarian notion, you know, that somehow before the conflict there was this very stable and very harmonious society, which the conflict breaks down, and that the idea of reconciliation, transitional justice, is to somehow get back to that. So that's one idea, which of course is kind of not a utopian idea. In practice, ahistorical. And a second idea is that, you know, how do you build this, the goal is a harmonious society, and how you actually do that. And usually in most of the literature on reconciliation, there is a linear process that's led out. There is a certain sequence that must be followed to achieve the harmony. It usually starts with some kind of dialogue, and then you have some kind of process of truth, dealing with truth, recovering the truth, establishing a narrative about the conflict, establishing who the victims are, who the perpetrators are, dealing with the perpetrators through justice mechanisms. And then at the end of that, you come to some kind of shared narrative about the conflict, which allows you then to build a kind of shared future, which is stable and harmonious. Now, you know, in theory or normatively, that might be quite nice to think that that would work. But in practice, it very rarely works like that. Associated with this concept, then, is there's a whole kind of new moral grammar that arose from the 1990s and has become kind of hardened over time about these issues, which makes it actually very difficult to critique them, because to critique some of these, everyone might say, well, you know, recovering truth about the past, that's a good idea. Or dealing with victims, punishing perpetrators, that probably sound like very good ideas. But the problem is that to critique them, it almost sounds that you're being illiberal and nihilistic to critique them. The other aspect that I critiqued was this idea of there's a certain guruization, if you like, in the field of reconciliation in particular. People like Jean-Paul Lederach, often religious figures who have very specific views, are very important and very influential in the whole idea of conflict transformation. And when you look at that, those ideas in detail, what you see is that they focus very much on the agency, in particular on the idea of the self. It's about self-transformation and how the self interacts with other selves. It's very rarely about groups. It's very rarely about group identities. And politics itself, in some ways, is pathologized. It's seen as emotive. It's seen as, holding the sort of political ideas that are not liberal, essentially, are seen as being controversial, emotive, not constructive for building a harmonious society. Now, in the case of Northern Ireland, I thought it was a good case, partly because I was working on it, obviously, but also because it is held in the period after the Good Friday Agreement, 1998, there was a lot of discourse around the idea that Northern Ireland was a model for conflict resolution. Everybody used it. You know, the American presidents, British, Irish governments obviously used it. European leaders used it. US presidents, often foreign secretaries of state and so on. They always said, oh, Northern Ireland is a model for how things should be done. But what exactly is it a model for? Because reconciliation and transitional justice actually partly figured in the settlement that was produced in Northern Ireland. That settlement was very detailed, nitty-gritty, institutional. Should I say 3 minutes or more?
Sure.
That the Good Friday Agreement was all about institutions. It had very little to say about reconciliation and transitional justice. And in fact, when it dealt with transitional justice issues, it was usually to basically kick any ideas about truth recovery or dealing with perpetrators or identifying who victims are. There's no agreement about any of these issues, so they were just kicked into the long grass completely and not dealt with. So it struck me as kind of interesting that this case is held up as a model by ignoring all of the detailed institutional compromises and focusing on these worldly-minded concepts, which actually are not implemented in the agreement or in the politics after the agreement. But still, Northern Ireland's institutions don't work today, largely because there is no agreement about the conflict. You can't even agree about who a victim is in the conflict. No agreement on very basic fundamental things. And that includes the British government, actually. They are a protagonist, and they were a protagonist in the conflict, and they are a protagonist in this ongoing conflict after the ending of the violence. Now, what I do in the article, really, just to come to a conclusion and not take too much time, is that much of the literature on reconciliation focuses on contact theory, which is devised by Alport in 1954, which was a study of segregation, desegregation in the United States, and emphasized that if you bring people together in, sort of an equalized environment, respectful, non-hierarchical, and bring them into situations where they can meet physically, that process reduces prejudice. That's the idea of contact theory, and it's fundamental to ideas about reconciliation. Almost every funding of reconciliation projects involves some kind of contact theory application, bringing primary school, secondary school, university students together in some form, or business people, or politicians, or just ordinary people, and getting them to talk together, meet together, do things together. And the idea is that contact produces harmony. It's a nice idea, but in practice, it seems to me, it's not something that's borne out by realities. But in the case of Northern Ireland in particular, what I focused on was, if you have a structurally segregated society, it's very hard for agency forms of reconciliation to work. Because if the idea is to bring people together, then you bring them together in some, one-day workshop format, and then they go back and live in their segregated environments. And in the case of Northern Ireland, they're also educated in segregated schools. And even in the university, students operate socially in a segregated way. Even in workplaces, people operate in a segregated way. It's all done in a very sophisticated way, but it's there. And that structural segregation is actually a huge obstacle to the agency contact theory approach. Now, how do you overcome that? Not so easy. I'll stop there because maybe I can discuss that in the Q&A.
Okay, thanks, Jim. And now we turn over to Rebecca Friedman.
Thanks very much. Thank you to Denisa and Jim and the organizers and the editors of Ethnic and Racial Studies for organizing the workshop today and publishing this collection of pieces. Definitely enjoyed being part of it and learned a lot. Can you hear me? Okay. So my piece today is on Peru, but the wider themes of the article are very much a one nexus of transitional justice and reconciliation, peace building, and that's transformative justice, or the contribution of transitional justice to conflict transformation. In recent years, transformative justice has been very much a buzzword in transitional justice theory and practice. So we hear a lot about conflict transformation, even transformative reintegration, now transformative justice as well. And transformative justice is, I think the emphasis on transformative justice has come from several different directions. First of all, it's part of a wider turn in transitional justice theory and practice that's simultaneously more backwards and forward looking, that transitional justice should address root causes of conflict, but also have a long-term contribution to peace building and democratization. And the idea that it should be contextually defined, so there's no one size fits all. But I think it's also a reflection of the complex recent context of transitional justice, especially since the end of the Cold War, so that transitional justice institutions need to be carefully defined and set up to meet particular local challenges and legacies. And also comes out of a general critique of what's seen as mainstream transitional justice theory and practice, a critique of a top-down approach, and critique of a very formal institution-building type of approach, liberal peace-building. But I think there's still a big gap in the literature on what, even though this agenda is well-founded and important, of what it actually means for transitional justice to be transformative. How do transitional justice institutions actually operationalize a transformative justice mandate into their proceedings? And I think, crucially for me in this article, if transitional justice is meant to contribute to conflict transformation, if it's meant to be contextually relevant, then which understanding of conflict is it meant to address? And I think so here we're at the intersection of transitional justice and peace building. If you look at the peace building literature or the causes of conflict literature, they're just as polarized, if not more, than the transitional justice scholarship. There's fierce contestation among methodological divides, but also lens of analysis on those who look at conflict as caused by big macro structures, inequality and injustice, versus those who look at conflict as caused by grievances on the individual level, for instance. So I'd look at the micro level. So this brings me to the Peruvian case study, which I think is an important case study for us today for several reasons. First, the Peruvian case was saw a very conscious effort by practitioners in this context to make transitional justice in Peru both contextually relevant and to contribute to conflict transformation. It was set up during a kind of global high point of transitional justice, lots of sharing of ideas, and this happened in Peru as well. It's the first and only Latin American case to use public hearings, for instance, which it brought over from South Africa in consultation with South African truth commissioners and practitioners. But it also pushed back against what it saw as external influence over the process and made a clear commitment, for instance, to use only Peruvian practitioners and to emphasize what it identified as the specific causes of the conflict in this case. And I think, secondly, Peru is important because it is such a highly complex conflict. So it's two decades of violence, extremely violent, but also at the same time very concentrated to certain parts of the country. Most of the victims were indigenous, rural, illiterate peasant population. A conflict with many actors, the Peruvian military and state actors, but also different insurgent groups, the Shining Path and Tupac Amaru movement being the largest. Many levels of violence, devastating micro-level violence, intrafamilial violence, a messy conflict, switching sides, and an ethnic dimension, so the targeting of indigenous populations. So in Ayacucho, where a lot of my research was based, nearly every family would lost one member, at least in the extended family. So the effects of the conflict in this region were profound. And the literature on the causes of conflict in Peru is very much divided. On the one hand, there's a large political science literature that's focused on the economic and political structural drivers of conflict, on smears, in some ways, the greed and grievance debate that's focused a lot on West Africa. But these explanations of conflict often focus on cocaine production and state marginalization of indigenous areas. So neglect, unequal structural injustices. On the other hand, there's a active psychosocial literature that focuses on individual level motivations and grievances, the emotional appeal to the Shining Path, micro level vendettas even, that the Shining Path provide an identity for rural youth, indigenous youth, generational rupture. So these were youth who had broken ties with the previous generation. There wasn't a lot of space for them. Frustrated expectations, shame, the politics of shame. And this literature has been very pronounced among Peruvian scholars, so it's often ethnographic, active among anthropology particularly. The Shining Path offered almost a political religion, a form of identity to the marginalized, and the group bonds that developed within this movement. So the research that I did for the article lasted about 8 months. It looked at rural and urban areas. It spoke to practitioners, transitional justice practitioners, but also war-affected populations, particularly those who testified at the Peruvian Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the CVR, the Comisión de Verdad y Reconciliación. And what's interesting and came out strongly in the research is that the CVR, in many ways, tried to address both understandings of conflict and started with a very ambitious, wide-ranging mandate. So on the one hand, it focused strongly on the longstanding political, economic, and social root causes of the conflict. It stresses this in its coverage of the and report. It collected 17,000 testimonies. Most of these came from victims. So it's highly pedagogical methodology, and it's also its recommendations, where it made a variety of recommendations for democratic reform and reparatory justice. But it also tried to, and this makes it very unique and different than other Latin American commissions, generate an inclusive forum where it sought to elicit the participation of ex-combatants, reach out to people on all sides of society to understand their stories and find out what motivated them to participate in this conflict in the first place. So in the article, I argue that despite its effort to incorporate both macro and micro understandings of the conflict, these came into tension over time in ways that were not foreseen originally by the commissioners. This applies especially to the CVR's engagement with ex-combatants, especially particularly the Shining Path, where the commission became increasingly cautious over time. Its engagement of the Shining Path was so controversial in Peru that eventually the commission still encouraged them to testify, but only, for instance, under the condition of what it called auto-criticism, that they would renounce the movement and their role in it to make it more politically and socially acceptable. Developed strong tensions with the military because it also sought to contribute to criminal justice. So this was not a South African type of commission. It did not make any provisions for amnesty at all. And eventually, as the commission's work became more and more controversial and was often accused of being pro-Shining Path to by the government, middle classes, the commission more and more began to focus on victims. And this is where it chose to spend its time and energies in developing victims' testimonies. So many wide-ranging implications, some of these beyond the scope of comments today. It even affected its narrative, which I argue in broader work. It ended up generating a narrative of generalized repair and destruction rather than direct responsibility and victimization. It became a commission that focused very much on victimization rather than protagonism, and or reconciliation without belligerence, as some of my interviewees put it. So I also stressed endogeneity in the article, so that these transitional justice institutions are instruments meant to lead to social change and bring about certain ends, but they're also products of their environment, and they're constrained by their environments. And so the CVR constantly had to make pragmatic decisions and decide where it would focus its very limited social and political capital to make the greatest change. This led to tension between commissioners, but also constant shifting tensions between the CBR and the wider society. So in conclusion, I think two broad takeaways. I think we have to think more carefully about institutional overstretch. So transitional justice institutions in recent years have been linked to so many ends. Do some goals limit others? So the Truth Commission that tried to at once elicit testimony, particularly victims' testimony, lead to criminal justice, lead to reparations, generate a very, very wide-reaching democratic reform program, create a very public critical historical memory. Are these goals in tension? Can the commission do all at once? In Peru, one of the biggest grievances among victims, like many other cases, was a lack or slow progress of reparatory justice. But what's striking, perhaps, I think, having spoken to many victims, is they testified long before reparations were actually on the table. So reparations was a recommendation the commission made later on to try to further rectificatory justice and bring some follow-up to victims. With victims primarily participated and told me that they testified at the Truth Commission to have a voice, and they thought that they believed in the objective itself of creating a critical historical memory and public record of what happened. But today, this is almost completely overshadowed, and the lack of reparatory justice has clouded this primary objective of critical memory and having a voice. And secondly, I think we have to be careful of the conclusions we draw. The frustration over reparatory justice has been widely picked up by others as well, and there's some who in Peru and elsewhere who've argued perhaps we should ditch transitional justice altogether, focus on development if reparatory justice is the biggest concern. But I think this is also dangerous. I think that, that reparatory justice is a form of justice, and it's not just because these are people struggling to make ends meet, but I think there's actually a danger of formal transitional justice processes of losing the effective contribution and focusing in the focus on structural injustices and inequalities. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Rebecca. And now over to Nadeem Ruhana.
Thank you. Thank you to Denise and Jim for including me in this project. And I'm happy to be here to talk about reconciliation and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Obviously, if somebody hears the issue, the topic of reconciliation in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, they would think that this is far-fetched. Realities on the ground are going in the direction of increasing, intensifying the conflict, and why is it relevant to talk about it? I think it's relevant to talk about it because we have to make a contribution both in conceptualizing what reconciliation in that particular conflict means and in thinking about it also theoretically. For example, Jim mentioned that the contact hypothesis that has been, you know, one of the leading approaches in dealing with intergroup conflict doesn't work very well. I agree with him, and I think that there are other theoretical approaches that we have to think about. My approach is that decolonization in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the essence of what reconciliation is or should be about. And I would focus on that. I think it's not only relevant and appropriate, but it's also the real and promising approach for dealing with the conflict that is of that intensity and of that nature. I think that this would not happen in the next year or two or five or 10 or 20. This is why it's important, because we have to set the grounds of thinking about it. Reconciliation, again, as mentioned by Jim here, is transforming the relationship. It's a profound transformation of the dynamics of conflict between parties in a way that both of them become legitimate for each other, and they accept each other and their existence and their political existence genuinely. That also involves issues of truth, issues of justice, issues of history, dealing with history, and so on. Now, is that what has been happening, historical responsibility? Is that what has been happening in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? If we look at the period of when negotiations started between Israelis and Palestinians, we notice that none of these issues has been mentioned. Since Oslo until now, there is no mentioning of truth, there is no mentioning of historical responsibility, of justice, or anything of that sort. What we have, actually, in the first meeting of Oslo, the very first meeting that happened between Israelis and Palestinians, a secret meeting, but, you know, one Israeli person wrote about it, as one Palestinian person or more wrote about it. The Israeli told the Palestinian wanted to talk about history, and the Israeli said, we are not going to talk about history here. And he really instilled the logic of the victor in the discussion for the what's going to happen. Israelis' understanding since Oslo until now, and even less now, is that dealing with the conflict means separating the two parties. Palestinians are there, and Israelis are here, which is actually impossible because Israel itself has about 20% of its citizens as Palestinians. So there is no discussion of reconciliation in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiation. Where is the discussion about reconciliation? We find it in theoretical contributions of many Israeli scholars. In my mind, I reviewed that literature quite carefully, and I think, and other scholars, Israeli and other scholars, I think that that approach to reconciliation that's emerging from a high power, from a dominant group, basically, of course, without it's not from a hegemonic way of thinking, suffers from three main drawbacks. The first one is that it assumes that Israelis and Palestinians are in a national conflict. That means these are two equal parties with national claims, and they have the equal claims to the land and so on. The truth of the matter is that if we look at it, both parties are not exactly there. This is the international discourse about it. Palestinians started looking at the conflict as a conflict between a colonizer and a colonized, somebody who came to their land, took it over, established an exclusive state for themselves, and in the process, because of the logic of the colonial dynamics, kicked them out of their homeland, or a large portion of them in their homeland. That thinking in the 1970s, for complicated reasons, started changing into, you know, let's talk about two groups that can partition the land. When that didn't work out, that also, the Palestinian side, they are returning to the colonial paradigm. And the Israeli side, actually, if you think about it, if somebody in the audience can think about it, who can tell me, what is the Zionist perception of the conflict with the Palestinians? Actually, it's an intriguing question, because the paradigm is a paradigm of a people going back to their homeland, where other people in that homeland are an irritant for that project. Right, so what kind of project they have? Although I must say that when they started the Oslo process, there were some people who were willing to consider the national paradigm. So I think that this whole literature about reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians is looking at the wrong paradigm. The paradigm is settler colonial paradigm in which decolonization should be the essence. What's decolonization? Is reaching equality, ending privileges, and so on. Okay. The second drawback is symmetricizing the conflict. Literature on this conflict looks at it as two symmetrically. What one part does to the other is what the other part does to the first part. So there is mutual denial. There should be mutual recognition. When we talk about mutual recognition, that means that the colonized have to accept the legitimacy of the colonizer, and then talking as if this is equal to the colonizer accepting the very existence of the colonized. The third one is psychologizing the process. And here there's a lot of work about, you know, contact hypotheses and getting together and dealing with trust and dealing with issues to do with interpersonal relationships, which in my mind are very important, but their importance should be part of a larger political process in which the decolonization emphasizes the power relationship and the power structure and the distribution of power and ending privileges, something similar to what happened in other parts of the world, like South Africa, although that's not perfect. But this should be the emphasis of the colonization process. So I think that in order to think about the future of the two nations, in order to think about a relationship that doesn't have what's happening on the ground on daily basis, we have to be able to offer a position, a vision in which decolonization, the political decolonization, is part of it. And of course, then we can talk about the psychological issues that are related to this political process of ending the privileges of one group and having equality and democracy in whatever political setting that would contain this democracy as what we should be working toward.
Okay, thank you, Nadim. Now over to Denisa.
Thanks, Bill. Yes, I'd like to echo thanks to everyone, to the journal editors for recognizing that we are trying to do something different with this very sort of established body of literature, sort of numerically and normatively, and to all the collaborators who have produced pieces that I think are moving this debate in somewhat different directions. So now I'll go straight on to my contribution, and I would like to start with the reflections on a broader research project which I have recently completed thanks to the support that I had from the Leverhulme Trust, and on which the paper that I produced for this special issue is a part. So, as a scholar of conflict studies, I have been puzzled by the mismatch between the regional nature of contemporary conflicts on the one hand, and the fact that post-conflict transitional justice mechanisms that are employed to address these conflicts, whether these were domestic war crimes trials or truth commissions, are invariably operating at a national level. So if we look at conflict trends, so the historical increase in the number of civil wars, or as they're called, intrastate wars since the Second World War, demonstrates a particular sort of really interesting trend in that we have an increase in the number of conflict that different scholars have named in different ways. Some talk about cross-border dimensions, some talk about internationalized internal conflicts. In other words, there is an increase in the conflicts which have some sort of cross-border dynamics, as well as sort of what we call regional conflicts. So, so in this sense, the fact that conflicts are interwoven with different political, economic, security dynamics across the borders has an impact on transitional justice and how it will be effective after the conflict. And it is not, when we talk about transborder dynamics, it is not just about the way sort of the wars are fought, that we have incursions of different groups across the borders, but it's also about the consequences of conflict. We have mass movement of populations, and the populations end up very often in neighboring countries. So what it happens at the end, at the point of the end of the conflict, is that perpetrators and victims end up on different sides of the border. So if you employ a national mechanisms, basically perpetrators will escape justice. And it is not just about sort of where people are, it's also about where evidence is. Again, these borders present an obstacle to getting evidence. And sort of, if you like, a more macabre example from the Kosovo conflict from the end of the 1990s, Serbs moved the bodies of killed Albanians from Kosovo into Serbia proper to cover up the crime and, of course, evidence and prevent the pursuit of justice. So the borders really create a problem, and the national transitional justice instruments are inadequate. So scholars have talked about, noted this mismatch, and they talked about an impunity gap, that basically perpetrators escape justice, and you actually cannot put in place the mechanisms that will adequately address the harm that has been done. And therefore, the argument has been, if we have regional conflicts, you actually need a regional mechanism to address the harm that was done. However, there is very little in the literature of, yes, if we have a regional approach to transitional justice, what might it be and how consequential it might be for the pursuit of justice. And this has been my starting point in the research. And this is where I looked at an empirical evidence from the Balkans, which is also the basis of the article in this special issue. And I have been following for a few years now a regional civil society initiative in the Balkans called the Coalition for RECON. The acronym comes from their final goal, and this is to establish a commission which will be regional and which will establish the facts of war crimes and human rights violations in the territory of former Yugoslavia. In other words, in the territory where all these wars were fought during the 1990s, which were a textbook example of a regional conflict. And indeed, in practice, this initiative really embodied this idea that you have to address sort of a regional dimension of conflict through a regional justice mechanisms. So as a group, they've had held extensive consultations at the civil society level with all kinds of people, with victims, victims associations, human rights and NGOs, teachers, artists, journalists, lawyers. And the aim of these consultations was to really think through a regional approach, consult as many people, and feed into the process of creating a draft statute for what this regional commission would look like. These conversations were recorded in terms of transcripts. They call them consultations, we can call them debates. There were almost 140 of them. And they took place at the local, national, and regional level. If you look at it, they're all available on the web. And if you look at how much sort of research material they produced, it's you could say a proper gold mine, because they left a trail of conversations of 4 million words. like, you know, what 4 million words looks like. It looks like 8 books of Tolstoy's War and Peace stacked up together. So to analyze these conversations, my co-author, Aude Bickley, who was based here at the LSE, at the Department of Methodology, we applied computer-assisted text analysis to a sample of data which amounts to about 500,000 of words, applying a particular software called Alcest, which allowed us to identify the patterns, thematic patterns in these debates. And we also, by doing that, we slightly refined our puzzle, because this difference between these kind of free-flowing discussions and the discussions that were focused on the statute allow us to actually compare the discussions that were, let's say, free-flowing, consultative, and discussions that were very, very contentious. For example, all these people from all different ethnic groups in the Balkans had to agree with where the seat of the commission would be, whether it would be Sarajevo or Belgrade or Pristina. So, so when we then looked at the themes, looked at our analysis, what was very interesting was that if we look at the contentious debate, we identify that these debates actually have a reconciliatory theme. Okay? This is a very counterintuitive outcome, that those debates that are more tense, right, more kind of discussion is more inflamed, also create this more reconciliatory reconciliatory theme, which is kind of against the grain of what you have in the literature, that if you kind of have contestations around the norm of transitional justice, therefore you will not have reconciliation. We unpack this even to understand how come we have such a finding. And what was really interesting is that it is the level of the debate that was explaining why this dimension is emerging in these contentious discussions. It pointed to the relevance of a regional level. So the regional level was doing something. At the regional level, people tended to focus more on really the sort of the nitty-gritty of the articles of the statute, and the regional level also seemed to moderate the ethnic framing of issues. So just to complete, then, to the extent that this piece also addressed what are the obstacles to and limits to transitional justice and reconciliation, it also raises a few questions that I would like to leave you with. So first, to the extent that it for the first time produced the evidence of the consequentiality of discourse at the regional level and pointed to the importance of the spatial level of justice seeking, sort of raises the question, how do really these different levels of justice seeking relate to reconciliation? So that is something that we need to understand much better in transitional justice scholarship. The second question is related to this idea of contestation. If this contestation about the norms does not necessarily prevent some form of reconciliatory discourse, and here in this context it was focused on the victims in a non-ethnic sense, we need more work to understand how the divisive impact of ethnically centered perspectives can be mitigated. The penultimate question is, how do we accurately assess the impact of transitional justice? We are always focused on some big goals, whereas here we look at the process that was leading to the transitional justice mechanism that created many of the dimensions and outcomes that we expect as an end process. So we need to, as an end goal. So we need to unpack the process. And lastly, sort of coming back to my empirical example, this has been a very successful, if you like, initiative at the regional level. It has provided an example, if you like, of a real grassroots society locally working and discussing issues, but it hasn't been able, or so far it hasn't been successful, to make the governments accept this this initiative, to support it, to make the commission happen, because the commission is supposed to be an interstate commission, which then raises the question, what is the role of the state, right, as opposition to the civil society, and what are the limits to civil society input in these processes?
Okay, thanks, Denisa. Rachel Kerr?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, and thank you, Denisa and Jim, for inviting me to participate in the panel and to read the special issue, which I'm lucky to have had in advance and been able to have a look through. Yeah. So my role on the panel is just to talk a bit about what's in the special issue and the themes that are explored in it, and to try and draw out some threads from that. So there's quite a bit to say in response to what is a very rich and diverse collection of studies. But I'll try to keep myself to 10 minutes, and I'll confine myself to sort of three themes that I wanted to explore. So the first is, what is reconciliation and transitional justice, and how is it understood? The second is, what is the evidence from different contexts explored in the special issue? And the third, what are the prospects for rethinking how we conceive of and apply reconciliation and transitional justice? So the title is Rethinking Reconciliation and Transitional Justice. How does this collection help us to do that? So first question is about what is reconciliation and what is transitional justice. And as is noted in the introduction, and as Jim noted in his introduction just now, they are dealing with their processes of contending with the past, their processes of dealing with legacies of violence and atrocity crimes, and both are contested. Both are contested terms, both are contested politically in terms of their operation. They're sometimes muddled concepts, and they're sometimes invoked without always fully interrogating their meaning. And I think the point is that they mean different things in different contexts and to different people. So it's hard to get a handle on exactly what is meant and come up with a single definition. I don't think we could of reconciliation and of justice, transitional justice. So they're both expressed both as normative goals in themselves, and they're expressed as processes. And in rethinking the terms and their application, I think we should also think about what the relationship is between the two. So what is the relationship between reconciliation and justice? I'll come back to that at the end. So in terms of reconciliation, does it constitute a sort of minimalist conception, as Jim sets out in his chapter, or a more maximalist definition? So is it about just getting to a point of coexistence, or is it about a transformative approach, as Rebecca talked about as well? Should we conceive of it as a goal or a process with no end? It's about relationships, but what kinds of relationships and what levels are we talking about? Is it about individual, interpersonal relationships, community relationships, societal relationships, interstate relationships, institutional relationships even? Or is it conversely about an individual coming to terms with one's past, or a state coming to terms with its own past? So it's about all of these different things. However it's conceived, reconciliation and transitional justice have increasingly been assumed to be necessary preconditions for sustainable peace. And as Denisa and Jim set out, it's become an unquestioned policy mantra to institute transitional justice and reconciliation as part of conflict resolution, peace building processes. And as such, it's been subject to the same kind of critiques as critiques of the liberal peace, that it's imposed, that it's top-down, that it's statist, and that in many senses it's deeply flawed. In some instances, it's been derided as a kind of reconciliation industry. An industry has grown up around this concept of reconciliation, which is something that we found in research that Denisa and I are now involved in the Western Balkans. And I think that's summed up really well in the introduction to this volume by Jim and Denisa. They say that the very terms reconciliation and justice have become at best sardonic references and at worst dirty words. So the question is, why has that come about? Why are we in this situation where reconciliation and transitional justice are policy mantras, something that's seen as important in instrumenting, instituting peace building, but are resisted quite strongly and they're hugely problematic in people's responses to them and the way that they operate on the ground. So what do we know about all of that? There are some studies that have demonstrated the shortcomings of transitional justice and reconciliation processes which challenge the normative agenda, so the idea that we sort of move from with empirical research beyond this kind of normative, faith-based drive for reconciliation, transitional justice, to a better understanding of how it actually operates in practice. And there's also been an expansion of different disciplines addressing these topics, which has contributed hugely to the richness of the debate, taking it beyond a kind of legalist discourse around justice in particular, but involving very different approaches and very different conceptions of reconciliation and justice. So in some ways it illuminates, and in some ways it muddies the water still further, because it's not clear that we're all talking about the same thing. So in this sort of context, the volume offers, I think, considerable insight by investigating a number of very diverse contexts. And as has already been said, some of them are quite different contexts and not the ones that you normally see in the transitional justice literature, which tends to focus on several repeated examples. And the aim isn't to ask how some predefined conception has been applied and then to judge, sort of evaluate success or failure on that basis, but rather to understand how the context informs and in some cases determines conceptualizations of reconciliation, justice, accountability, victimhood, reparation, all of which are hugely contested. So it seeks to reframe the terms of the debate and to rethink reconciliation, transitional justice. So what does it tell us? What evidence does it give us? Second thing to think about. So processes of reconciliation are conceived of and play out in very different ways. We know that all of the situations are very different, or there's a huge diversity. So how do we start making sense of that and trying to frame some sort of conclusions out of this diverse set? And I've suggested a frame that we might use of different contextual factors, social, cultural, historical, and political. And I just want to sort of pull out a couple of threads from a few of the contributions to the volume, and you may well take issue with the categorisation that I've put them in. But in terms of social, Jim's already talked about his chapter and discussed how segregation in Northern Ireland is a block to making the contact theory of reconciliation work. It's a block to interpersonal reconciliation. That contact, say, needs to happen in the everyday. It's not enough to take X number of people from one community living in segregated situation and put them with X number of people in another community and have an activity around reconciliation and think that that's going to result in something. There needs to be an sort of everyday interaction for contact to work. And there's also well-documented resistance to those kinds of reconciliation efforts in Northern Ireland, which sort of takes us back to this idea of reconciliation industry and the resistance to the ideas that it can be imposed. So the second sort of set of contexts is cultural, and I wanted to discuss Denise's article in that sort of context. So the work on RECOM analyses discourses of reconciliation in different spatial dimensions and shows how reconciliation might be conceived of as dialogue in the context of norm contestation. I think that's really important because it shows that reconciliation in this context is the process itself. It's involved in this process of contesting and discussing what should occur in the future and sort of challenging those norms. So it's the everyday practices of reconciliation that matter. And then historical, so several of the chapters engage historical legacies, particularly colonial legacies, has already been established, and seek to consider them and consider remedies in terms of reconciliation and transitional justice. So Nadim addresses the Israeli-Palestinian relations, we've already heard about that. And there are chapters on legacy of racial segregation in the US and the legacy of harm done to indigenous people by the Australian state. And in all those cases, reconciliation is conceived of as a restructuring of relationships, recognizing inequality and power dynamics in order to transform a new, more equal relationship. So it's a different sort of notion of reconciliation. It's kind of transformative, this transformative sense, this decolonizing sense. And that, as Nadima acknowledges in the chapter, I think quite honestly at the end, is easier said than done. In the American-Australian case, attention is focused not only on the recasting of relationships, but on the need for justice as a means to reset those relationships. It's not just about reconciliation, but it's the tying into justice and reparation as well. So apologies aren't enough, and only serve to reinforce reconciliation as political discourse rather than as justice, transitional justice. And this sense of politics, I think, is something that runs through all of the chapters and runs through our understanding of what reconciliation is and how it relates and the problems associated with it. So there's hugely wide divergence in all of these examples. They're in the sense that they're all very complex, and they're all very messy. We told off talking about thorny issues before, but it's very difficult to work out what to do. And again, Denisa and Jim posit it as a choice between a number of poison chalices with no satisfactory outcome. In which there's it. So in the implementation, one of the threads, we sort of pull out some common themes from all of this, and one is the gap between expectations and reality, and between normative goals and pragmatic constraints surrounding them, as we've discussed. But there's also dissonance between resistance to notions of reconciliation and everyday practices. While there may be resistance expressed, nevertheless, you might be able to see processes of reconciliation going on in the everyday. So in that sense, reconciliation is not this kind of transcendental goal of something that's going to happen, but it's embedded in how people negotiate and contest difference, which means that we shouldn't see reconciliation as the achievement of a shared narrative, but rather, as Denisa says, in terms of shared intention. So it's a shared undertaking. And then just a couple of points to finish up. One is that there's a tension, I think, between reconciliation and justice, which perhaps lies at the heart of some of the definitional issues. So far from being framed as opposites, which they were, reconciliation and accountability, or reconciliation and justice, are now framed as mutually reinforcing in peace-building terms. They both are supposed to go together. But it's quite hard to align justice and reconciliation, and some of the resistance to reconciliation comes from this notion that it undercuts efforts at justice, that it's being chosen to replace transitional justice, to replace claims for justice. So in that sense, those goals might be irreconcilable, as was observed a few years ago. So all of this, I think, leads to a resistance, and then reconciliation is picked up as a sort of diversionary, the idea that reconciliation is a diversionary discourse to take away attention from questions of justice. And in that sense, it also can lead to the continuation of politics, as Jim talked about at the beginning, that reconciliation dialogues, rather than resolving conflict, can end up rehearsing those things that led to the conflict in the first place. And in that sense, reconciliation is a continuation of politics, continuation of the Civil War. So if we reframe reconciliation and transitional justice as a means of contending with the past and negotiating the future, leave you with the observational question that perhaps this is not only to do with a rethinking transitional justice and reconciliation, but somehow getting beyond what's become a fairly polarising set of debates around what they are and what they should be.
Okay, thanks, Rachel. We've got about 15 minutes for questions, less than I anticipated, but I failed in my efforts to keep everyone within the time. So there's a rolling mic, right? So I'll take four questions, and please make them questions rather than announcements. I'll just leave it to whoever here wants to answer the questions. So has anyone got any questions or comments at the front there? I'm going to take four in a row, so this is your opportunity.
I think many historians and writers think, you see, that unless the issue of decolonization is recognized, Ian Pepe and Bax Matar, you see, quite a few, reconciliation and transitional justice cannot be achieved. Unfortunately, the Zionists think that this land was given to them 2,000 years ago. So they are not the colonizer. They are just returning their own land. So I would like to panel to explain to me how this thing can be reconciled.
Anyone else?
Yes, on the question of reconciliation, I mean, I don't think any of you have really given us a practical definition of what we mean by that. I'll give you just a possible one. I come from what was former Yugoslavia, which is no longer there, as you know. It has been replaced now by six republics, and there has been a conflict. One way that I could see people reconcile is what had happened after the Second World War, when in fact Yugoslavia was recreated, in the sense that the bulk of its citizens were working to make it a better state. In other words, there was a significant loyalty to it. But here, I should think the one thing that is lacking is loyalty of the various ethnic groups, if I can call them, or national groups, to the states in which they have now found themselves. I'll just give you the example of Kosovo. Kosovo is the result of a massive international US-led intervention, which, by the way, has flagrantly breached the UN Charter. So we have now a much bigger international issue there. You have essentially two main groups there now. One is the Kosovo-Albanian one, which now is over 90%, and there is a very small remaining Serbian population. The Serbs used to make up about...
Can you just make it into a
yes, 30,000 Pristina, they're down now to under 100. How do you expect them to be loyal to this new U.S.-created state? I mean, this is a problem that you're going to have in Bosnia. It's a problem in Croatia, everywhere. I think you need to address the issue of loyalty and how the constitutions of those countries work.
Thank you. Anyone else for a question over there?
I was wondering if the panelists had any thought on bystanders when victims and perpetrators are identified in the reconciliation process. How do you address bystanders in order to have a society that functions for years to come?
Just one big question. For any of the panel members to answer as regarding how far do you think a legal institution like the courts can help in achieving reconciliation, or is reconciliation in a completely extrajudicial process which happens completely outside the legal system?
Okay, we might have a bit more time than I anticipated, but let's just see, can we have answers to those four questions, beginning with a comment on Israel and Palestine.
I think this is a very hard question, your question, and it's hard politically too, in the following sense. I don't want to spend too much time on it. But if we think about the conflict, and I ask students and faculty here, which paradigm you think concept you would use to describe this conflict? They can use a number of paradigms. I mentioned three of them. I mentioned two actually. Settler colonial paradigm. Some people believe it applies. Some people, like Israelis, of course, believe it doesn't. Some people say national paradigm and so on. The third paradigm that's emerging now is a religious nationalist paradigm. And it's really hitting roots in the Israeli public. As you know, the political map is moving in that direction. Now, it would be intellectually intriguing, actually. I was writing something in the last few days, and I wanted to say about what Israelis, what paradigm they think when they want to conceptualize the conflict. I couldn't find something more than the thinking that this homeland is theirs, and they are coming back to their ancestors' homeland after 2,000 years or whatever, and then there's a group of people there who is really who's a nuance and irritating the project of revival of the Jewish state in their homeland. And in the settler colonial context, you deal with it with a number of ways if you compare it to other, and every single one of them applies. For example, riddance of the population. For example, cultural erasure. For example, control of the space. Israel itself has 20%, I mean, the land was belonged to Palestinians. The Palestinians now control 3% of the land. So control of the space, demography, space, culture, and so on. So it's very hard. I don't know what to tell you, actually. But I'm with you that it's very hard to conceptualize it. And I think that if this is the conceptualization that's going in Israel, that's hitting roots in Israel, we are going to a very difficult period. This is why in my presentation I thought that it's very important to think about theoretically and politically what is the alternative. And this is really what I'm trying to do. The bystander question about that is very important. I think the world is bystander in this. Germany today recognizes Israel as a Jewish state. What does that mean, the German Bundestag? What's happening in Gaza and the world looking about? The assassination in Malaysia, you know, there was an assassination in this country and the world didn't, you know, there was an international reaction to it, right? The Russian spy. There was a Palestinian scientist assassinated by the Israelis yesterday or the day before. Nobody. So there is a bystander effect there. And I think that the thinking about reconciliation in that sense of decolonization should offer us ways of putting our political, intellectual, and moral efforts in that direction.
Okay, question about loyalty to the state.
Okay. I think that's a really, if you look at the Balkan example and if you look at the evidence, not just from my research, it shows that it's much easier to imagine that you can reconcile peoples as opposed to states. And when I talk about peoples, I do mean people even who have suffered. Because this particular initiative that I have analyzed, you could actually see how victims from different ethnic groups do come together and they can find some sort of common language and understanding from the predicament in which they've found themselves, and are also motivated by very strongly and very movingly, I would say, that what they've suffered, no one else suffers again, as opposed to states. And I think this really puts a spotlight on what kind of a state you want and who you are pledging loyalty to, because I think some of the most interesting theorizing, and Bill has written that in his latest book, Nations Torn Asunder, is that really these wars, so many of the contemporary wars, they end in a sense that, you know, people stop shooting, but many of the structures of those wars are kind of continue, right? And I think therein lies a huge problem, in the Balkans in particular, where you can trace the continuity in people, ideologies, from even the pre-war through the war period that's kind of becoming actually even more extreme now. So I think that was, I think before we start talking about pledging loyalty to home, we do really need to kind of think, how can you really, if states are a very important part in this puzzle in terms of bringing sort of some sort of reconciliation about what you do, what you do about that state, what you do about those entrenched interests there that are actually actively opposing any sort of reconciliation? I could talk more. Why is that?
Okay, on bystanders.
I'd like to talk about the loyalty issue. Obviously, it's very easy to say that all of these issues involve a lot of complexity, and it's very difficult to kind of see your way through to some kind of satisfactory solution. But what strikes me, a couple of things strike me about these issues. One is that we tend to forget the possibilities for change. You know, in the 1970s, no one thought apartheid would fall. The 1960s, no one thought that the Stalinist regime in Northern Ireland would disappear. Again, very quickly. Apartheid also fell apart fairly quickly. Yugoslavia collapsed very quickly. I mean, the possibilities for change are always there. You know, Israel, the state is only, whatever it is, 70 years old, I think, or 70 now. You know? Who knows? You know, we shouldn't underestimate the possibilities for change, and even sudden change. And I think if you look at some of these cases, in relation to loyalty, reconciliation, you see certain types of options. I mean, we can, by looking at the cases, we want to know what are the options for a divided place, you know, where you have a contested territory, you know, different groups, different identities, contesting the same space and living in it, and possibly in a violent contact. A violent conflict and possibly in a post-conflict situation. You know, but we can look at particular cases and we say, what are the options? What has been done in these particular cases with what result? So, for example, if you look in somewhere like Northern Ireland, you could say, well, Northern Ireland was always a contested place, but for many decades there was no violence there. And we've gone from a situation where there was majority, where the majority group, the unionist community in Northern Ireland, which dominated the political and economic and cultural and social situation in the place, are now having to share that part with the nationalist community. And if you look at the agreement, in terms of loyalty issues, there's a lot of very interesting sort of concepts. You know, I can hold British and Irish citizenship jointly. You know, the Irish government has a kind of official droit de regard, if you like, in Northern Ireland, accepted in the agreement. You know, so those are massive changes. There's a lot of issues about flags and symbols in Northern Ireland. It used to be a criminal offence, more or less. I mean, it was interpreted as a criminal offence to wave the Irish, you know, to display the Irish flag in Northern Ireland. I mean, it's done, you know, sophisticated way. The police said it was a public, it was encouraging public disorder, and therefore, if it was displayed, they intended to go in and try and take it down. I mean, you know, that's not long ago. It's like 20, 30, 40 years ago. It's still a problem, but we're moving to a situation where those kind of symbols, you know, where there's kind of sophisticated thinking amongst some people about binationalism, you know, respect for traditions. At least the discourse is there. You see something similar in Kosovo institutionally in terms of it's maybe being imposed from without by the European Union about institutions, you know, decentralized institutions for the Serbs. I mean, at least there's a discussion about it, and, you know, there's a big division in the Albanian community about giving the Serbs autonomous power, but at least, you know, there's a discussion about it.
You don't really see any kind of discussion like that, like either of those other cases, in Israel, in Israeli-Palestinian case. There's just a lack of acceptance. Now, that's more like South Africa, say, in the 60s, or Northern Ireland in the 50s, or, well, it doesn't really apply to Kosovo, but, you know, but it's more like those other conflicts at a much earlier stage. And what I would say is that we look at the other conflicts, we see big changes, therefore we shouldn't rule out big changes in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict either. Would it be possible, you know, to have some kind of binational citizenship, you know, would it be possible, Israelis tend to get very upset because Palestinians don't respect the Israeli flag. Well, why can't you have two flags or two anthems or a different anthem or a different flag? You know, South Africa has a different flag, different anthem, etc., etc. You know, these are not, these symbolic issues can't be overcome. So I was just addressing the question about loyalty. You know, there are other experiences where loyalties have kind of been muddied and made fuzzier.
Anyone on bystanders?
I think in general, and it's an important point, I think in general transitional justice does not really address bystanders well or engage with the broader work. Indirect victims or more secondary perpetrators. So it tends to focus strongly on direct victims and indirect perpetrators, so those who bear the greatest responsibilities, it's often said. But I think the CBR in Peru did make a conscious effort again to emphasize bystanders, and often said that its primary stakeholders were victims of the conflict, especially indigenous victims, but its primary audience were middle classes, those most removed from the conflict who turned a blind eye to it, those in the capital cities. And it ran the Truth Commission very much as a pedagogical process, had a very strong moral discourse. The president of the Truth Commission often referred to the commission as offering moral education for elites. And of course, I think one of this in already a very tense and polarized society, this ended up having the opposite effect, and I think isolated the commission even more from those who it was trying to reach, so it didn't have the desired effect. And people approached the commission and the entire transitional justice process.